business to be in. So her girlfriend asked her to take a gun with her whilst she was working, just to keep her safe as a safety means. Now, unfortunately, Eileen was making even less money doing her prostitution than she was before. So her girlfriend ended up going back to work at hotels anyway, which made Eileen paranoid that she would leave her. And this caused an almost trigger effect to her to spin out of control, as we saw from when she confessed her girlfriend was her one phone call when she was in custody. And later on, I'll go a bit more into this, but her girlfriend actually was kind of one of the reasons that she got arrested in the first place. So she was actually betrayed by her girlfriend, but she still had this really deep love for her girlfriend and a paranoia that her girlfriend was going to leave her and betray her. Probably stemming from the fact that she never met her birth father. Her birth mother abandoned her when she was a toddler. She was then adopted by her grandparents, and she didn't know she was adopted until later on. Her grandparents were very abusive. Her grandfather physically and sexually abused her. And there's a whole stem of things from her childhood that you can very much follow leading into this. And this feeling of paranoia that's quickly making her spin out of control. So then it gets to November 1989. And Eileen meets a 51-year-old man. And they decided to party together. And he drives out to the woods where they are drinking and they're talking. And Eileen claims that he wanted to have sex with her, but was refusing to pay her. And so when she refused because he wasn't going to pay, she alleges that he attacked her and brutally raped her repeatedly. But when he was taking a break, Eileen said she took her handgun and shot him 4 times, the gun that she was told by her girlfriend to take with her as a means of safety. After shooting him 4 times, she then took the contents of his wallet and covers his body with some carpet she found in the trunk and fled in his car. When she returned back to her home with her girlfriend, she was badly bruised, bleeding, and she told her girlfriend what happened, but her girlfriend refused to believe she'd murdered him, refused to believe she'd killed him until she saw the news report of the death, obviously on the news. But she didn't leave Eileen, and she later confessed to the police that at the time, she felt like Eileen had let out all the frustration from her system for whatever reasons she was hated society, and that she would be okay after that. Obviously, we know that is not the case. With Eileen being charged, I believe she was charged with 7 counts of murder, because there is one that she was not charged for. Because Eileen, later after this, will shoot and kill a 43-year-old man who had picked her up and also become violent with her. And so she takes his gun, money, jewelry, and car. Now, she alleges that he was violent with her, but she quickly then abandons the car because she's afraid of being seen with it. She starts hitchhiking. While she's hitchhiking, she meets with another man who was also a devout Christian. When we remember that when she was in prison, she was a devout Christian, and got into the teachings of the Bible. And so she meets another man who is a devout Christian working for an outreach center. Now, it's unclear what actually happened, but Eileen claims after talking with him for a while regarding his outreach work and him offering to help her that he demanded to have sex, to which Eileen said that she then shot him, took his belongings, and drove off in his car. Now, this is being her first mistake, because this event of her stealing his car ends up actually leading to her arrest, because her girlfriend was driving the car, unaware that it was stolen, when she took a corner too fast and rolled the car. So the couple panicked, asked witnesses not to call the police, and they fled the scene. But obviously the police were called, and when they realized who the car belonged to and that this person was reported missing, and the witnesses who saw the car roll could provide a very detailed description of both Eileen and Taria, because they'd asked them and begged them not to call the police. So they ended up having detailed descriptions of themselves in a car of a missing person, which Eileen had killed. So then over the next 5 months, Eileen would end up killing 5 more men, claiming all were in self-defense, with both her and her girlfriend being on the run, And they were living in hiding for the next 3 years, which is where overtime flyers with sketches of their faces were circulating Florida. And the police were actively looking for them. And then one night, Eileen went out to buy alcohol and Tyria abandoned her, traveled to Pennsylvania to stay with her sister. And it was shortly after that that the police connected Eileen's fingerprints to the stolen items and she was arrested. So this is when she has killed 8 men, is what was claimed, but she was only charged, I believe, with 7. So she then spent a year in prison before her trial, and when she goes on to trial, she realizes her girlfriend is being called as a witness by the prosecution. And this is where Eileen realizes that not only had her girlfriend abandoned her, she'd also betrayed her by going to the police. Now, this is where the trial is probably the most interesting part, I would say, of Eileen Warnos' case, because you can look really in depth with media representation and how she was portrayed in different kind of ways. So with her trial, she was the only witness for her defense. And it became very notable, and I think the reason she got a lot of media attention in her case was because of how bizarre her behavior was when she took to the stand. She was making statements regarding the fact that there was electronic monitoring devices being planted in her and that she was being watched by hidden cameras. And a lot of people had their own different theories and explanations as to what this was. Some thought she'd inherited a predisposition towards schizophrenia from her family because her dad had committed suicide in prison from schizophrenia. Others thought she was just pretending to be insane, with her defense claiming she'd been permanently damaged from all the abuse she'd suffered and developed a borderline personality disorder. However, ultimately, the jury disagreed. They found her guilty of the murder of the first man she killed, because that was all she was arrested for. And as she was led out, she yelled at the jury that she was innocent and that she was raped and that she was hoping the jury got raped. And now that was the first of numerous outbursts that happened during the penalty phase of her trial, where she was sentenced to death, because across the next 2 years, she pled guilty to 2 more counts of murder and no contest on 3 counts. So she was never charged with the death that ultimately led to her being arrested, which was the one where the car was stolen and rolled over, because the body was never found. But she was found guilty of all the others, and ultimately she was sentenced with the death penalty. And I believe that she was executed in 2001 or 2002, I believe. So that is kind of the story of Eileen Warnos and what her crimes were, why she was classed as the first female serial killer, and how things kind of panned out for her. Now, there are some significant contributing sociological factors that have been researched into why women choose to kill through an analysis of case studies, and Eileen Warnos's one is a very prominent one, because you can see a lot of those sociological factors contributing to her life, whether they are explanations as to why she was murdering men, but they are very present in her life. Now, this is a paper by Danielle Kaya from 2013, and it came with a list of some of the factors that will contribute to women who kill. And she did a whole span of looking across, I want to say it was 10 different female serial killer cases that she cross-analyzed this list with. So it's a very extensive paper. I would recommend anyone to read it. It's very interesting, because all of the serial killers are different women. They have different victims, different types of victims, different formats of victims. I would definitely recommend reading that paper. And I'm going to, because I feel like I've just spieled a whole load of stuff about Eileen Warnos, that I'm going to take a quick song break and then come back and just finish it off of kind of more analysis into the sociological kind of factors as to why women kill and how you can relate it to Eileen Warnos and why she was killing. And I'm going to relate to her again next week, because she has, like I said, her trial was a very interesting trial. She did a lot of what is called face work, where she was creating these personal constructs and she was shifting narratives, playing a victim, hero, villain narrative with the jury. and everything. So she's a very interesting case to look at from multiple different angles. But before we get into that, I would like to play the song Homesick by Catfish and the Bottlemen. They are another English band. I have played them before. Again, I really would recommend checking them out. I think they have a really cool indie rock sound and one of my favorite bands as well. So we'll be back after this song.
I got misled, mistook, discarded anything that I said. See, I'm not the type to call you up drunk, but I got some lies to tell. She hates her work but loves to flirt. It's a shame she don't work with me. She gets uptight, don't like when I'm gone, but she won't let on to me.
Mixtape is not lost. Tune in to the Vancouver Mixtape for your own personal mix of Vancouver's best independent music, interviews, and more. Join me, Jesse, and my co-host Jamie on our trek through Vancouver's underground, Sunday nights at 8 o'clock on CJSF.
The Sexual Violence Support and Prevention Office, SVSPO, offers confidential support, advice, and referrals to SFU and FIC community members, including students, staff, and faculty, who have been impacted by sexual violence and misconduct. The SVSPO is a welcoming place where you can access support without judgment or assumptions. We work from a survivor-centered perspective, using an empowerment and trauma-informed approach that considers individual situations and perspectives. Please reach out. Services are located at the Diamond Alumni Center, room 014 on the lower level. Please reach out by email at sv-support@sfu.ca. That was sv-support@sfu.ca.
And welcome back to Sociologic here on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby Campus and Community Radio from Simon Fraser University. I am Rebecca and I'm going to be your host for the remainder of this hour up until 8 p.m. when it will be Bitcoover coming up with our music coordinator, Connor. So just to kind of wrap up this episode tonight, as I will be doing a part two to this next week, so definitely tune in again next Tuesday, 7 to 8 p.m. some sociological factors as to why some women have been killers directly relating to the Eileen Wuornos case, because she actually experienced 11 of the 13 factors that was from this research paper, making her the best example of how living in a constant state of anomie and experiencing the strains of societal demands could lead to a life of violent crimes. So starting off, number one, abusive parents and guardians. Wuornos, her maternal grandfather, was very abusive towards her, touched her sexually, kissed her passionately, and was verbally abusive as well to the family around her. Now, a broken and dysfunctional home life is number two. She was adopted. She was abandoned by her birth mother when she was still a toddler. She was raised by strict and abusive grandparents. She never met her dad. He was in the army, and then he was arrested, and then he died in prison. So she never met her dad. Poverty. She never had a stable home after she moved out. She had a very short-lived marriage. She was working on the streets. I'm not sure what her living situation was, but she was kind of in and out of poverty. Then the fourth one is physical and sexual abuse by someone other than a parent or guardian. Now, the whole kind of basis of her case was that she claimed she was raped by 8 men. So that is that as it is. And that she was touched by other men and things like that, and that she was beaten by men. From the first guy that she killed, she came back badly bruised and bleeding. So that is where she comes in on that one. Abandoned / neglected by someone other than a parent or guardian. Now, this paper says that she experienced this because she didn't know she was adopted, and the case of how she was raised eventually ended up being very similar to being abandoned by her birth mother, as she was the victim of very emotional, physical, and sexual abuse alongside her brother by the hands of their grandfather, who they thought was their father. The next one's rape. Basis of a lot of her claims during her trial. Now, the next one is abusive husband / spouse. That one, she is one of the two that she does not come under. Employment issues. She never had a stable income or employment at all. She was in and out of prostitution, like I said. She was hitchhiking. She didn't ever have like a stable job because she couldn't obtain an education because of her home life. She dropped out of school. One of the values that caused her to feel anomie potentially, because she never got that goal of obtaining an education. The next one is a drug habit or addiction. This one is the only other one that doesn't apply to her. Then there's alcohol dependency. As I said before, in her case, she was very much struggling with funding her addiction to alcohol, which was why she was in and out of prostitution, and that the money that she was getting from her grandfather's life insurance settlement wasn't lasting. Then unwanted or unplanned pregnancies. So between the ages of 13 and 14, she got pregnant. She claimed a friend of her grandfather's had raped her, so she was sent to a home for unwed mothers to give birth, and the baby was put up for adoption. And she said, I believe she said in her trial, that she didn't think that she would be a fit mother either. And then the last one is mental illness resulting from life events. So her father was schizophrenic. From her actions on the trial, people thought that she was had a predisposition, there we go, to schizophrenia from her father. Now, with all of those factors, she's got 11 of them. They're very broad. But in most cases of female serial killers, more than one is present, with all of them being considered very significant social problems that would defy the norms of society, therefore supporting Durkheim's theory of anomie and normlessness. But it is clear for many women who do experience these, they do not become serial killers. That is the smaller part of the population that happens to. Now, she was abandoned by her birth parents. She was raised by dysfunctional grandparents. Her grandfather was physically and verbally abusing her. This is a very unhealthy representation of what family looks like. She lacked parental support and supervision. She performed poorly at school because of this. Dropping out before graduation, that hinders her ability to read or write effectively. That prevents her to be able to obtain a stable job. leading her to turn into prostitution. So that is a very difficult kind of background and entry into life, if that is your childhood. And then it is said that in these research papers into her case, that after she was allegedly raped by one of her clients, she developed a fear that it would happen again, stating that she murdered her rapist in self-defense. So when she felt threatened again, she committed murder once again to protect herself. Now, this is because in her mind, the acts of normlessness, committed against her had to be corrected by her committing further acts of normlessness. Normlessness. My God, such a confusing word. And then additionally to this, the strain of not being able to achieve these basic goals of society, like obtaining an education, like gaining a stable form of employment, led her to create her own norms in order to survive, which is as Merton's theory explains. So her perceptions of reality were already distorted from an early age, and then they continued to be molded in a distorted fashion from the experiences in her life of dysfunction and hardship. So this is where we have a look at like some of the sociological factors that can contribute to explaining why women turn to be serial killers when they are seen as these passive, submissive stereotypes, or gendered stereotypes in society, which is what I want to go into more on next week's episode, is the media representations and the legal narratives in explaining female serial killers and why women could commit such violent extreme acts when their gendered stereotype and characteristics associated with them are so polarized in the other direction. I will also like mainly be drawing on this theory called the Mad, Bad and Sad. Now this is a theory that reinforces the traditional stereotypes that the patriarchal system of society relies on by either victimizing or demonizing or pathologizing female serial killers. So what we also see with this is that the legal and media narratives on female killers has an impact on their sentences and their treatment in the judicial system too. So there's a lot of factors that go into it. And not accepting the idea that women have the autonomy given to men in explaining how and why they commit such violent acts. I'm not here promoting the violent acts. I'm just saying that there's different explanations given to women than there are to men when you look at the media and legal narratives. So a quick overview is that the MAD is the masculinization of women, and looking at lesbians, killers that have been in lesbian relationships. The bad is that women are born inherently bad in their biological makeup, so they deviate away from the traditional stereotypes of passivity and submissive maternal nature. I'm going to be touching upon Lombroso as a key person there. And then sad is a traumatic event led to them committing actions, so they subverted from the traditional stereotypes. And I've got four case studies that I'm going to be kind of using in looking at this mad, bad, sad typography. Andrea Yates, and she drowned 5 children in a bathtub. Janine Jones, she's responsible for the deaths of up to 60 children under her care as a vocational nurse. And similar to that one, Lucy Letby, she's charged with the attempted murder of 8 infants and the murder of 7 infants when she was a neonatal nurse between 2016 and 2017 in the UK. She was demonized a lot in the media as this cold, calculated, cunning person. And then Amanda Knox, who she was wrongfully convicted of the murder of her fellow exchange students. So she's not actually a female serial killer or killer. But the media portrayal when she was convicted is very interesting because she was both sexualized and demonized. So she's a really interesting case that I found that I want to talk about. So that will be next week's episode. I just want to thank you all for tuning in. If you did stay tuning in, I'm going to say next week's one will also be a bit of a dark episode. So stay tuned for BitCouver coming up next with our music coordinator, Connor. And tune in again next week from 7 to 8 p.m. to hear part 2 of female serial killers and their explanations and media representations as to why they are who they are and why they did what they did. And that's all from me. So I will see you all next week.
let them knock like crazy. Cause I'd not seen her in months, and she knew how to save me. But the crack though carried on. And I know I push boundaries sometimes, but she knows she's worse. I've missed it, I was bound to. And I just come along for the ride, and I tried my best to keep away from you. For the ride, and I tried my best to keep away from you, but you've just stepped off a flight, and now you beg for my company, 'cause you know I give it to you.